Hello to everyone listening. I'm Tia. I'm one of the evaluators that was brought in by Amnesty International UK to evaluate its Brave campaign.
And hi, everyone. My name is Lauren. I'm the other consultant who's working to evaluate the Brave campaign.
Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here. And hello to everyone listening to this podcast.
Indeed. So this is our second podcast, isn't it?
Yeah, we did our first one really looking at the labelling of human rights defenders, which is very interesting. And please feel free to go back and listen if you like.
Indeed. So today we want to share some key findings from the Brave campaign evaluation. We want to look at expected, unexpected, looking at impact, and hopefully drawing some lessons that Amnesty and others can use for future campaigns.
Absolutely. Maybe we really need to start right at the beginning and tell our listeners what the Brave campaign was about.
I think that sounds like a good place to start.
As far as we know it and our exploration into the Brave campaign, this is that this was a campaign to support human rights defenders, to help or enable them to be better protected, connected, supported, and recognised. And these were these sort of four outcomes that we used and integrated throughout our evaluation. And the campaign used multiple different strategies to try and achieve that aim for human rights defenders, working on different cases, so individual human rights defenders, working with the UK government, lobbying and advocating for them to better protect human rights defenders through new policy strategies or guidelines, for example. They also did a lot of work around increasing awareness in the UK public, so having everyone become more aware of what a human rights defender is and how they can support them, for example, by writing a petition to a Member of Parliament, or by tweeting or sharing a post on social media. So there's lots of different strategies that they took here. And those three main ones being lobbying the UK government, working with the UK public, and really working on individual cases where human rights defenders were at risk or there was an increased threat to them in different countries around the world.
Oh, that's a great overview.
And I'm sure we'll delve more into how those activities manifested through this podcast. So that evaluation, sorry, that campaign even took place over a 4 or 5 year period, starting in 2017, building on different projects within that campaign. So the campaign wasn't just sort of one major lobbying piece. There were lots of different projects that arose throughout, and we'll talk a bit more about those as we go through.
That's a great summary of the work that they did. And of course, the report that we've done for Amnesty International UK is public, so you are more than welcome to dive into the details of our methodology, the approach, and some of the things that we found. Today, we won't go into as much detail as we probably want to with everything, but we'll give a quick overview of some of the things we found. Should we talk a little bit about how we got involved, what we did?
We started out working with the Amnesty International UK team, who supported us in really helping to understand what Amnesty is about and what campaign is about. And we'd really chosen an approach that was reflective of the complexity of human rights work, particularly the different changes that manifest in different stakeholders. So we used qualitative comparative analysis. I don't know if you want to give a little overview of that.
Qualitative comparative analysis is a big mouthful. It's basically looking at recipes. So if we are looking at one of the outcomes where human rights defenders feel better protected from threats and reprisals, then what are all of the ingredients that go into people feeling that way? It's nice because we looked at the things that were kind of internal to Amnesty's work, but we also looked at the external environment. So we looked at the ways in which the political context may influence how people feel. We looked at solidarity or feelings of solidarity with the UK public. We looked at a kind of a range of ingredients to try and figure out what's the recipe that most often gets people to the feeling of being better protected or being better positively recognized by staying better equipped to undertake their human rights work, and better connected to other human rights defenders and to other agencies, decision makers. So the idea behind qualitative comparative analysis, we can just demystify the lengthy name, is just looking at recipes. If you want to make a spaghetti bolognese, what are all the things that go into that? And so that's really the methodology that we applied, because it lends itself really well to complex environments and understanding all of the kind of different things go into an individual's experience. So for us, we looked at cases and we looked at human rights defenders as one collection of cases. And then we looked at the Brave Campaign's projects and initiatives as another set of cases. And cases are those things that we investigate in greater detail. So what we were able to do is identify some of the recipes for projects that, you know, are designed to better equip people, what the features of those projects, and, you know, what are the kind of factors or conditions that make people or lead people to feel better protected, connected, recognized, and equipped. So that's the methodology we took.
And I suppose then, you know, by learning how a recipe is done, presumably you will do that recipe better next time. Ultimately, the campaign will take on perhaps a different set of ingredients.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. One of the things that we were able to say is, you know, when you do these two things in combination, people generally tend to feel that they're better connected to other human rights defenders or decision makers. So it does allow for future campaigns to be a bit more targeted in their work. Now, that we looked at a snapshot in time, we looked at very specific things. So it's almost an opportunity for Amnesty and others to kind of prove or disprove the case in different contexts, because, you know, the benefit of QCA is that it looks at complex environments and not necessarily static environments. So things very well could change in these environments, in these contexts for individuals or for projects, and that might lead to different outcomes, though the goal is to get them a little bit closer to understanding the experiences of each individual and of the projects.
Right. That's really, really interesting. And I think, as you say, our listeners can read a bit more about QCA in their report if they're interested. And I think one thing that, yeah, QCA really brought
qualitative comparative analysis.
The perceptions piece, right? And how human rights defenders experience the campaign, decentering how, you know, the campaign expected them to experience things and actually determining better, did they experience things the way that we assumed would be the case?
Yeah.
Which slightly brings us on to those three objectives in our evaluation, which we should probably mention. Of which, so we had these three objectives for the evaluation. And our first was to really look at the positive and negative outcomes of the campaign overall. Did the campaign achieve its objectives? Did it situate itself within the theory of change established? Secondly, looking at the experiences of human rights defenders, did they experience the campaign as expected? And what was it like working as partners with Amnesty International UK? And then finally, a piece on systems of oppression, whether the campaign challenged or reinforced systems of oppression and inequalities. And so we will touch on those three parts.
What an interesting collection of objectives.
Yeah. Very.
I mean, I don't think that I have very often seen an objective of an evaluation, you know, where an organization is really looking at where they may have reinforced systems of oppression. And I think, you know, we'll get into it a little bit when we talk about the findings, but creating a conceptual model for systems and applying qualitative comparative analysis as a methodology and an approach is quite an interesting thing. All right, I'm going to stop geeking out for a minute.
So I think we should move to our top line findings and share those with you. But before we do that, we really want to just acknowledge and thank all the evaluation participants that contributed to this evaluation. Every conversation and piece of information analysed added to the richness of the findings and learnings that Amnesty International UK can take forward to create better and more impactful campaigns in the future. So really a heartfelt thanks from myself.
Indeed. I think, you know, for us, we benefited from the time that people took, certainly from the human rights defenders who shared their stories, their you know, challenging and uplifting stories. I know that we were both really moved by all of the conversations that we had. So, you know, we interviewed a lot of different people as part of this evaluation, from Amnesty International staff in the UK and in the Secretariat. We interviewed partners, political figures, interviewed human rights defenders, as I said, and, you know, all of those conversations were earnest and candid. And, you know, just from my position as an evaluator, I learned quite a lot about ways of working.
Great. So shall we get into the findings?
Yes.
Great. So, Tier, what was one of the key findings for you?
I think for me, one of the key findings was the relationship between outcomes. And by that, I mean, so just going back, when we looked at the outcomes of human rights defenders feeling better protected from threats and reprisals, better connected to other human rights defenders or decision makers, better equipped to carry out their human rights work, and better recognized, and we looked at recognition and as a positive and a negative, I think one of the interesting findings for me was that human rights defenders felt better equipped when they were better connected. And so looking at the relationship between the outcomes, for me, was quite an interesting one, because now that we think about it and reflect on it, it seems like a fairly obvious one, in that for human rights defenders, they need a range of skills to undertake their work, and things that, you know, I hadn't even thought of. So digital attacks on their websites, censorship, legal training. One human rights defender was talking about training they received on how to answer questions while being interrogated by military police. So there's a range of skills that human rights defenders need to undertake that work. And when they were connected and had broad networks that they can draw upon to get those skills, those were kind of mutually reinforcing outcomes. Obviously, there's lots of, you know, all of the recipes that lead them to feeling better connected, or all of the, you know, not recipes, but all the ingredients that lead them to feel better connected, and all the ingredients that lead human rights defenders to feel better equipped. That's kind of one piece of it. But really, it was about the relationship between those two outcomes. So for us, one of the things that we recommended to Amnesty is that, you know, when you're looking at setting targets and setting goals for your campaigns, couple connecting and equipping human rights defenders as one singular objective and aim, because they, you know, they come together really nicely, or did in this instance. What about you?
So the thing that really stands out for me in terms of findings is the influencing on the UK government, and how through pressured lobbying on members of parliament, Amnesty International was able to increase recognition of the importance of human rights defenders in different departments of the UK government. Mm. And as a result of that, Amnesty would no doubt contributed to the establishment of a set of guidelines. And these guidelines were to go to different embassies around the world and support the UK government in better working with human rights defenders.
And those guidelines are called UK Support to Human Rights Defenders.
Yes, exactly. And so I think that was a really key win, if you like, for Amnesty in terms of getting human rights defenders on the table and being an important part of the UK government strategies and thinking moving forward.
But it was more than just lobbying, right? Because Amnesty made contributions to that document.
Yes, exactly. They edited that document. They worked with partners to make sure the language was correct, to make sure that it was sensitive to the issues of human rights defenders. Absolutely. And I think that's a really strong connection in terms of how Amnesty as an organisation is able to contribute to policies that can protect human rights defenders.
We had a bit of a mix, though, didn't we, in terms of human rights defenders being aware of the guidelines. I think on one end, we had human rights defenders who weren't entirely clear where the guidelines were sitting. But then we had others who were aware of the guidelines and, in fact, used it to put pressure on their local embassy, which I think is a great approach of, you know, you've got these guidelines, they're rolled out by government. What are you doing to really kind of make manifest the recommendations and the approaches that are described in that? And that's quite a powerful, it's quite a powerful tool, right? Because I think sometimes, you know, on the more pessimistic side, you can say, oh, there's guidelines and, you know, you take them or leave them, how many guidelines, how many documents get thrown into the universe. And that's a real tangible example of where the guidelines were used to put pressure on the embassy to act. And there are accounts of, certainly from that human rights defender, where they did act, they did do something different, they did change, including putting funding towards human rights defenders and their work. So
quite
powerful, isn't it?
And maybe, you know, there's an area for exploration there in terms of the relationship between those guidelines and human rights defenders and what factors enabled that kind of internal lobbying.
What we're looking for in the evaluation are all of the tools that are used by human rights defenders to like better enable their work, right? And the guidelines is another tool of human rights defenders in terms of kind of really expanding the reach of what they're trying to achieve.
And then I think the second sort of goal is for the UK government to set up a strategy on human rights defenders. And so NSD created on the Human Rights Frontline report that included up to 80 human rights defenders or consultations with up to 80 human rights defenders, and enabled human rights defenders to create policy recommendations within that report. And then that report was sent to various members of parliament and government officials, again, as a lobbying tool, but also as a way to connect human rights defenders' recommendations to the people who may be able to put those in play.
I think it's one thing to pass a report off to politicians, but how was it received? When we went back and did our evaluation, what were political figures aware of it?
Yes, they were aware of it. And I think the extent to which that as a singular tactic on its own is effective was not necessarily a concrete line of inquiry in our evaluation.
Okay.
However, I think that in a combination with other lobbying and relationship building factors maintain the pressure. And, you know, we did hear from some political figures that because of this consistent kind of background pressure from Amnesty, they did go to the embassies and double check how they were using the guidelines. And they did want to gather the evidence and give it to members of parliament so they were prepared for those questions.
Right.
So I think that there's a degree of not maybe the research or the requests are singular, but as a combination of factors that they did that.
Indeed. And I think we can see a line through the evidence of pressure of human rights defenders who are working in partnership with Amnesty. And we're seeing evidence of those questions being brought into spaces, for example, with the Foreign Commonwealth Development Office by members of parliament. So we can see a bit of a line of, we're creating documentation, we're resourcing you, we're putting pressure on you as a member of parliament, and then you're seeing questions being asked in public spaces about these cases that are being worked on. So it's a really nice trajectory, a really nice line.
And let's not forget that a lot of that happened in the backdrop of Brexit and COVID, which has, you know, major factors that affect how change happens in political spaces. I mean, you know, commendable to have any.
Well, when you've got COVID sort of dominating the space, you know, I think one of the things that we looked at was the usage of the term human rights defender. And we did see a kind of a dip in media usage of that phrase around COVID, when kind of COVID was really beginning to take flight. And I think it's particularly, you know, commendable is exactly the right phrase, because you've got something else that's, you know, a pandemic that's dominating the news cycle, that's dominating everyone's personal and professional lives, and that you're still able to carve out space for human rights defenders within that it's a powerful push.
Indeed. Okay, so let's run through a couple of other key findings.
Okay, because we spent too much time on that one.
Well, in the interest of our listeners' time.
No, they don't have 40 hours to spend with us chatting about findings.
Okay, so let's run through a couple of others. We found that human rights defenders felt better connected to decision makers than other human rights defenders, particularly strong when it came to connecting to other human rights defenders as a means of feeling solidarity, as a means of feeling that collectively they understand the challenges that they are facing.
Yep.
And even learning new strategies from each other. So one of our recommendations was to really elevate and find ways to better connect them.
This connection one was an interesting area of exploration for me, because I certainly was aware, you know, one of the things that came out of the findings for us is the fact that connection, being connected, had such a significant impact on people, positive impact. But there was some disproportionality in the ways in which human rights defenders were connected. So some had were brought to the UK, were put in front of members of parliament, had action cards, loads of social media traction, and others not as much. And so one of the findings and was that, but also one of the recommendations from us was, you know, given that connecting people to other people has such a huge benefit, such a huge impact on how they are able to undertake their human rights work, disproportionality in that is problematic, right? So that the goal of amnesty should be about better connecting human rights defenders so that they can experience the benefits of that connection.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe a bit of a segue to that is the Rise Up Project. So the Rise Up Project was designed to equip youth or young human rights defenders through a training course. So they would equip a group of diverse young people from across the UK, bring them together over different training weekends, then they'd learn about campaign strategies, about how to manage social media risks when it comes to campaigning, for example. And that came through as a really, really positive project in terms of connecting young activists and young human rights defenders together and also equipping them with skills that then enhance their confidence to go on and practice human rights defender work in their local constituents. So, for example, working with schools and creating meetings around Black Lives Matter in schools, for example. So that, I think, came through as a really strong and positive project, and it will be a legacy of the Brave campaign, hopefully. That's something that they will continue beyond the end of the campaign. And so the evaluation really sort of echoed that level of positivity around that project.
So we've talked about the government and their role and the campaign's interaction with the UK government. We haven't spoken that much about the UK public and where they featured in this. Can you just remind our listeners what the ask was of the UK public?
Yeah, so the campaign was reaching out to the UK public to ask them to take action in support of some human rights defenders around the world who were at risk or where their particular case or situation had changed negatively. So, for example, maybe they had been imprisoned or maybe they were receiving threats from the government. And so the International UK, as part of this campaign, had a number of priority cases that they would put out action cards, social media, tweets, Instagram posts, asking for petitions or send emails to the UK public and Amnesty members with the requests of, please will you write to your Member of Parliament or please will you sign this petition, for example. The ask was really to have the UK public engage in these cases and build that pressure for some kind of action from the UK government.
And how'd that go?
I think we got a mixed bag. I mean, I think the UK public across the campaign took over 800,000 actions in favour of a human rights defender case or situation in solidarity with them, if you like. But to what extent those actions translated into sustained support or translated into action from the UK government is much varied and much harder to refine. And in a lot of cases, it seemed like the UK public or, you know, your neighbour or whoever would take a one-time action, maybe, and then that might be it. The number of actions that we saw for each human rights defender varied considerably.
I guess there's kind of there's like a few things in the mix, right? So you're having to check, or you're having to monitor the extent to which the UK public really latch on to a case. Because what we saw is that the UK public kind of, there was more traction around some human rights defenders in their cases than there were for others. And then the sense certainly was that once there was that kind of buying moment, that traction, you know, getting a kind of interest from the UK public, that's when Amnesty would really kind of hit the gas pedal on that particular case. I think there's one of the things that we found is this kind of approach of, you know, we're just looking for as many, we're just trying to get as many actions from the UK public as possible is one tactic, because you're looking for when the UK public really bite on or latch on to an idea. But then you need that kind of, as you say, like that kind of sustained pressure, because the idea is for the UK public to take action to create pressure. And one of the things that we found was that we didn't see that pressure being created unless there was a specific amount of actions taken on behalf of one case. And so from a campaign perspective, that's was quite an interesting finding. And I know that Amnesty was really kind of keen to dive into this finding, is that, you know, when you're setting goals and you're setting targets, having the UK public take actions, you can have as many actions as you want across a whole campaign. But where you really get traction, or you really get the pressure, that kind of like buildup of critical mass, at least in the Brave campaign, you had to have at least 50,000 actions, unique actions taken, to create that kind of pressure on the government to do something, which I think is quite a useful finding in terms of what you can take forward as an organization. And that, you know, if you've got, you know, 15 different cases or agendas or individuals that you're campaigning on behalf of, you know, the 850,000 is only 850,000 actions taken is really only significant if you got a really solid concentration per individual or per case or per project or per initiative. Which is a useful thing, I think. And one of the things that Amnesty has certainly said to us is that this is the first time they've had a kind of a concrete number that's attached to something. And what supports that finding is looking at the human rights defenders that we interviewed, looking at their exposure, so the things that were done on behalf of them, so these solidarity actions, as you said, but then also things that were brought forward by members of parliament, by seeing some sort of traction. I personally would be really interested in looking at this component much more comprehensively across a bigger sample.
A couple of other key findings we should mention here. Firstly, case improvement. Yeah. So as part of the Brave campaign, Amnesty International UK had 5 priority cases.
Mm-hmm.
And what we mean by that is 5 priority human rights defenders and their cases through which Amnesty worked on improving their situation. So, for example, one human rights defender, Amnesty International UK, would take their case, put out in fundraising appeals with the action cards, put them into the sort of UK publics and work on increasing awareness around their situation, again, as an angle for pressure. They may also work with individuals in that country who are associated with Amnesty as activists or sections and build pressure by attending trials or lobbying local groups, for example, or building local partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
So of those 5 cases that were set out, 4 of those cases received or were reported to have a positive outcome. And that was seen as a positive part of this evaluation. And what we found was that while Amnesty cannot be solely attributed for changing the circumstances of those human rights defenders, Amnesty certainly had to, as a partner in that lobbying piece for the case to change. Amnesty's reputation, name, and contributions were certainly a key part in enabling that positive outcome for those human rights defenders.
I think as well, that's your contribution, attribution, put that to one side. One of the things that kind of came through really strongly in the interviews is the relationship between human rights defenders. Because when we're looking at like emotional affective states, so feeling the way that human rights defenders feel and perceive, one of the things that I thought was just a really interesting piece was that human rights defenders really identified and associated themselves very closely with Amnesty. So that relationship led to quite strong positive feelings. So even in the absence of case improvement, so I'm thinking about, you know, there's, you know, 5 priority cases, 4 case improvement, 1 case deteriorated. In that case that deteriorated, still very strong positive feelings associated with their relationship to Amnesty and the work that they were doing on their behalf. So that was very much a feeling of the kind of their external environment and context having a greater kind of influence on their case deteriorating, but that their relationship to Amnesty as being a kind of driver and supporting force. So I guess what you could gather from that is that even if a person's case is deteriorating, their relationship to Amnesty and the work that Amnesty is doing is not impacted in that way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I'm curious then, how does that relate to our other findings around mental health strains on human rights defenders? I was wondering maybe if you could elaborate on that relationship.
Big thing that came up around this idea of human rights defenders feeling better equipped is that, yes, we can talk about skills, we can talk about knowledge, but the big kind of gap that we fall into is that being equipped isn't just about skills and knowledge. Being equipped is about your emotional readiness. And so human rights defenders talking about the fact that they're experiencing post-traumatic stress, that they're experiencing re-traumatization, that, I think we were both really acutely aware of this. You know, when you're asking somebody and you're interviewing somebody as part of an evaluation, you're asking them to tell a story. And human rights defenders have incredible profiles, and they are part of this story because of really hard stuff that they're, one, dealing with a personal level, two, combating on a much broader scale. So their story is inherently a hard one of challenge. I know that for both of us, we were having people telling us these very, very hard stories, and these really challenging stories that were emotional and difficult. And in that process, you can hear that it's coming up again. And, you know, for me, if I'm relaying a story of something that's challenging that's happened to me, I feel it again. I live that experience again. And one of the pieces for us is that these human rights defenders, which is kind of linked to another finding, is that the human rights defenders that Amnesty was working with in terms of being priority cases were priority cases for other organizations. So imagine that you're not just telling this story for Amnesty, for their evaluators, for their campaign outputs. You're telling this story for this organization, for this organization. You're doing that same activity of retelling the story 4-5 times over within any given cycle, because you've got midterm evaluations, final evaluations, you've got baselines, from that perspective of having to interact with and engage your story, the part that sells your story is not sells your story, but the part that draws people into your story is the negative part of your story. I certainly was struck by that feeling. And I know that that's something that we see, that's something we drew out of our findings and our recommendations, is to look at the fact that human rights defenders are telling hard stories over and over and over again. And that being equipped to undertake that work is not just about, okay, well, you've got skills around combating cyber attacks, but what is it about having to retell that story? Not just retelling that story, but this is also about your lived experience. You're retelling the story, but you're living in a context that is oppressive, that is dangerous. What do you need? What does your emotional readiness look like?
Pretty powerful. And it really does beg the question, what is the evaluator's role in managing that, both collectively with the organizations that you evaluate with and outside of that, as a ethical process, as evaluation consultant? How do you join up that ethical process rather than just jumping in?
But, you can expand on that as well. Is like, what is the space for other organizations to hold that when they're interacting with other organizations? And so this is one of the recommendations that we made to Amnesty, is that, we appreciate it's not your sole responsibility to look after the ways in which the human rights defenders that you're focusing on interact with other agencies, but it is your responsibility to have an awareness of what that might look like and how that may be impacting individuals, which is something that you know, they've really taken on board and they've heard in terms of the ways that there are different storytelling methods. There are different ways that you can have an individual, a human rights defender at risk, engage in and share their story without exposing them to having to directly tell their story repeatedly.
Absolutely. That's a really powerful piece, I think, that came through. So a couple of additional key findings I think we should mention. Working with partners, which is a really fundamental strategy of this campaign in terms of collective action, in terms of working with partners to write the On the Human Rights Frontline report. So we found that partners, as much as you said around human rights defenders, reported positively about working with Amnesty International UK. They were very appreciative that Amnesty had evolved to be more sensitive to the added value of what they bought, and were really sensitive to considerations around timing and their participation and what was possible and so on. However, there was a degree to which partners wanted to contribute more. And there's this kind of fine line between, you know, as a large organization like Amnesty International UK, I have an idea. Let me think through this idea. We're going to do this idea and then let me bring the partners in. Versus, should I work with partners before I've even developed an idea and actually use and brainstorm together the ideas? And so I think we found through our evaluation that at what point partnerships start to evolve is actually a really key point in which partners feel valued and feel that their contribution is more meaningful.
We can blow out the concept of partnership to include human rights defenders, right?
Absolutely.
So we think about the partners that Amnesty was working with for the On the Human Rights Frontline report, but we can also think about human rights defenders as partners in that work as well. And one of the things that we reflected back to Amnesty is this, is their active participation. Is that a ladder?
Yes, it is.
It's a ladder. Okay. And that, you know, there's a, you're working from a range of kind of informing one-way information flows to really actively co-designing co-accountability. Can you have co-accountability?
Yeah, no.
I've set it into existence. Really sharing responsibility and owning things together. And so this idea of, you know, we've both worked in this space for a while now. So we get that, you know, you've got a project, you get the project off the ground as a lead organization, you know, the space with which you have to really actively engage, meaningfully engage, operationalize the word meaningful first, and then do that can be constrained by a number of different things. So one of the things that we did find is that people's perceptions, partners and human rights defenders, their perceptions of their engagement with the campaign was kind of mixed. There may have been some informing, there may have been some consultation wherein Amnesty goes out, says, you know, what do you think about this? Takes that information, runs with it. But the real piece that they were missing was that deep participation, was like towards the kind of higher end of that participation ladder, where it's about joint decision making, it's about coming to solutions, solutioning together. And I think that means that there's a lot of space for Amnesty to grow in its partnerships and to grow in its, you know, we're big fans of kind of participant-led models. So, you know, consider a world where, you know, this is a human rights defender led evaluation, right? Mm-hmm. So the things that are most important for them to look at and for them to understand and for them to appraise and critique of the campaign is led by the people for whom the campaign is for. I think there's room to grow. There's absolutely room to grow in terms of participation and perceptions of involvement and engagement with the campaign. It's, you can't uncouple that from the fact that people felt very warmly and positively about their interactions with Amnesty. Mm. So you could say one interpretation of that is, you know, you can improve on the participation of campaign participants, or you can say the way that you're operating is kind of okay for now because people are happy.
I mean, I think that there is something to be said around the speed in which it operates. You know, the ability as a large organization to act quickly is beneficial when you need to quickly address a case in a country that's deteriorating, but the extent to which you can bring your partners with you at that pace, I think is an interesting one on the participation ladder or potentially a barrier.
I think there's also the other benefit of the bringing human rights defenders, particularly into the design. I think that like some of the assumptions that the campaign made in the beginning when they designed it were based on kind of internal assumptions about the way that they thought things might be related to each other. But if you go back in a way, way back machine and having the benefit of these interviews and these conversations with human rights defenders, what you might find is that those internal assumptions could have done with a bit of a revision, which meant that the way that they were targeting their campaign projects and initiatives would be different. And so I think that, you know, there is a real benefit to involving campaign participants, beneficiaries, people for whom you are delivering these campaigns in the beginning, just to challenge and check those assumptions. And I do know we've had conversations with Amnesty where they've said, we were really interested in how we can bring human rights defenders in as, you know, part of a reference group or as members of the steering committee, but we didn't want to be tokenistic, and we were aware of the burden, the additional time burden that would create. And there's kind of an awareness, and I don't think either of us are suggesting there's a perfect answer to it, or that human rights defenders exist as a monolith, and therefore, you know, having a few human rights defenders is sufficiently representative of all of the human rights defenders that you want to be working with. It's a complicated question that doesn't have a simple and straightforward answer. But I do think that there's a lot of space for there to be much more involvement so that you're campaign programming is much more targeted.
So I think we need to talk about two more key findings before we move on. What I think we really have to mention is the project. So Subject Spirit was a project that focused on working with the media to elevate what it means to be a local human rights defender. And so they got lots of local newspapers on board, regional, even national newspapers.
Nice.
Out a call across all these newspapers for notable human rights defenders, specifically women human rights defenders, who had been defending causes in their local communities or in their local towns. And the uptake was much higher than had been anticipated. And it was one of Amnesty International's most successful media campaigns in its entire history. It was a huge, significant win for them in terms of working with the media and generating awareness around what it means to be a human rights defender. But more to the point, the connect between what it means to be a human rights defender in another country and what it means to be a human rights defender in Manchester or London or another city in the UK, for example.
And wasn't the model that they took for Suffragette Spirit so successful that other sections adopted the approach?
Yes, exactly. So I think that one is a real worthwhile mention. And secondly, I think we should briefly mention Pride Inside as a project within this campaign that focused on LGBTQI causes as part of Pride Inside Festival. And because it was during COVID, there were no sort of on-street festivals or anything that was happening in the public space. So Amnesty decided to take it online and brought in a huge array of diverse voices. They created a website platform. They had lots of different speakers across sort of half an hour to an hour online events where people could engage with those speakers on various topics, where people could comment, people could just listen or engage however they wanted. And then human rights defenders also participated and contributed in those events, and human rights defender cases were also sort of embedded as part of a package of awareness into the whole program. Again, local civil society LGBTQI partners also worked with them on developing this event. So I think it's really worth mentioning how successful that project was in terms of pivoting during COVID, planning, you know, a public in-person event to then taking everything online, engaging a range of different partners, and also creating space for diverse discussions for all sorts of different groups. So I think it's really much. A final key finding here is the third objective on challenging or reinforcing systems of oppression. What key points are important for our listeners there?
I think I would say the first bit is, you know, systems of oppression being a really unwieldy term, and how you investigate that is kind of a challenging piece. So for us, what we did was we looked at the ways in which inequality may be reinforced at a kind of a systemic level. One of the things that we found was that largely everything was in the English language. Things weren't translated into other languages, whether it's a website or, you know, the nomination page for the Brave Awards or anything for Suffragette Spirit. A lot of things were conducted in the English language, which therefore kind of reinforces the primacy of the English language and accessibility for other human rights defenders who may be operating in other languages. And related to that would be around digital literacy levels. So if everything's in an online platform, if you don't have access to the internet or you don't use the internet as much, what does that mean in terms of reach? And that's kind of reinforced by, you know, human rights defenders that Amnesty is working with as their kind of priority cases are ones with very high profiles already. So what does that mean about lesser known human rights defenders? So you may have somebody who's been defending human rights for a long enough time that they should have a high enough profile. But if they're doing it in a context where they, you know, access to the internet isn't as good, or for a number of reasons, and, you know, what does that mean? What does that look like?
So there's an extent to which
we're reinforcing this by doing a podcast in English.
That. But also that, like, the whole international space is reinforcing systems of inequality by focusing on the same individuals, right?
Yeah.
But then my question would be, but does it not take that to achieve change? Like, does it not take 10 organizations focusing on one human rights defender to initiate change versus the splintered approach of spreading in one or two organizations across many to see significant change?
Yeah, I guess if, you know, there is that, but there is also, if I were to say, you know, the benefits of having an international organization focus on your case. We don't know whether it's, you know, is it one Amnesty? Is it Amnesty plus that gets people out of prison, out of their pre-trial holdings? Is it, you know, what is the thing that does it? Like, what's the kind of critical mass for an individual who's defending human rights to feel some level of protection and recognition? We don't know what the number is that creates that. But if you've got a human rights defender who's got, you know, 15 agencies who are calling for them to be, you know, released from prison, who are doing online appeals, who have given them a lot of social media traction. What about the other voices that aren't there? What about the other human rights defenders who aren't as well known, who are in very similar situations, who have been disappeared, who have, you know, we don't know what that looks like. But I think there's something to say to, there's something about looking at the balance. And this is a phrase that you use quite a bit, which is assessing the balance of what it means to be working. You know, if you've got Amnesty International as a secretariat working on some of the same priority cases, where do you, as Amnesty International, as a UK section, do you put your weight behind the same ones in an effort to kind of bolster that case, knowing that that case is also being represented, reflected, and supported by a number of other human rights focused organizations? Or do you say, we're going to put our kind of weight as a national section behind a lesser known human rights defender to amplify their voice? In terms of another systems of oppression piece, I would say that one of the things we didn't find was a reflection on context, like sociocultural context. And I think that matters. I think it's useful. So while we, let's take Suffragette Spirit as a good example of that. The suffragettes movement of the, you know, early 1900s largely excluded Black and Brown voices, even though it was about, you know, women's rights for all women. But you very rarely, particularly in the UK and in the States where I'm from. So when commemorating the suffragettes movement by launching a project around the suffragette spirit, there's a real opportunity there to say that these voices were excluded. But when we looked back at some of the documentation, at the videos, at the things that people were saying about the suffragette spirit as a project. It was wildly diverse. There were trans women, Black, Brown, Indigenous women. You know, there was a lot of diversity in that space. So there's an opportunity to kind of reclaim that as a movement, or reclaim representation within that movement. And the same for Pride Inside. You know, we didn't see any reflection on the history of the Pride movement. It was very much located in the now, which has its own benefits. But then you exclude the important voices of Black and Brown trans women who kind of led the Stonewall riots, which kind of elevated the movement of what we now know as Pride. So, at least in the States. So I think there's an opportunity to reflect back on history and reflect back on where these movements, where these important social pieces are coming from, as a way of not covering up the voices and the bodies and the ideas that laid the groundwork for where we are now. I don't necessarily think that Amnesty is disregarding them, but in their absence, there's a space there to really reflect on what the journey looks like, so that you're creating a whole picture and not just a narrative that suits the moment that you're in. I think as well, in terms of the Brave Award. So Brave Awards nominating human rights offenders. There was a panel that had journalists, Amnesty staff, and some activists on it, I believe. And I think given the level of connection and what connection means to human rights defenders and how valuable it was, the idea of having a winner and a non-winner is a little challenging there, because the winners had like social media stuff. They, you know, they got a lot of exposure off the back of winning the Brave Award. But that may have meant that it disenfranchised or disadvantaged to some extent nominees who didn't benefit from that exposure. Now, I do recognize the fact that there could be some issues with consent that interacted in that space in terms of how exposed people wanted to be. But anytime you've got a kind of an award system, I always think that somebody's going to be disadvantaged in some capacity because they have not won.
So another key finding in the systems of oppression is where human rights defenders are brought into spaces to talk to political figures, that's often bringing them into a space where there's a power imbalance, where human rights defenders may not be fully prepared to speak to political figures in a space they're unfamiliar with. And so what we found was that sometimes there needed to be greater consideration for what that means, in addition to perhaps greater consideration for creating spaces that are on a more level playing field, or spaces in which human rights defenders feel more comfortable or more equal to political figures that often carry perhaps a higher stature, particularly when it comes to influencing the situations in their particular context. So to do that, there's recommendations to consider those kind of spaces, that common ground, for example, in a cafe or wherever is comfortable for all parties involved.
There's two bits, though, to this piece, isn't there? In that, you know, some of the people we interviewed felt that human rights defenders who were better able to make the sell were brought to meet politicians. So there's an imbalance of bringing human rights defenders into political spaces where, you know, human rights defenders said that they felt like reasonably prepared, but it's a completely different ballgame when you're bringing it into a space that's comfortable to a politician versus one that's comfortable to a human rights defender. But then there's another piece around who you decide can meet. You know, this is going back to that connection piece. Who you decide is appropriate to meet a member of parliament. And there's that imbalance, or there's a dynamic that exists in that choice.
We presented a lot of findings and we've really gone into a lot of detail, but let's narrow it down. Tia, what do you think was the most significant impact?
I think the most significant impact would be the positive impact on people's lives. So on individual cases where there was an improvement, I think that's a really significant impact. I can say that probably the next one for me would be in creating the on the human rights frontline report and the contribution to the guidelines, because we see that being a kind of another tool, as I said before, like with human rights defenders. So yeah, for me, people first, then tools.
Right. I would also agree that I think one thing that really stood out for me was just the appearance of human rights defender as a term in the integrated review in the UK government. So the evolution, not just from human rights defender guidelines, but that human rights defender as a term is now being featured in review of the Foreign and Commonwealth Development Office. And that kind of seamless, or what seems to be, as you said before, that trajectory of human rights defender across a lot of their tools and guidelines and their terminology. You know, we had people report to us that they've become more aware of the complexities of the situations that human rights defenders operate in, that it's not just about violence, that actually it's complex digital threats. And that kind of recognition, I think, is a really, really concrete way of ensuring a sustainable focus on human rights defenders beyond the end of this project. So we know that Amnesty International UK will continue to work with human rights defenders, whether the government does so or not, is to a large extent out of their control. So I think that it's appeared and will appear in that strategy as a really key sustainable piece for the UK. I think at this stage, the outcomes are at that sort of nascent level, and over the next couple of years, they materialise into being more longer term change in outcomes. So something that really helped us to get into the detail and understand how Amnesty works is having a positive relationship with the internal project team. And I think one thing we'd like to just touch on briefly now is what it's like to work with a large international organisation on an evaluation, and really reflect a little bit on, as consultants, what we experienced and how that impacted or influenced our evaluation. Tia, what was it like for you to work with Amnesty International UK?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we were struck by, and I was struck by in the beginning, was the extent to which they were willing to invite challenge. They invited challenge and criticism and critique, and I think, you know, pushed us to be much more critical in areas, which isn't necessarily something you see very often, particularly when you're conducting an evaluation that interacts with a public-facing document. So I think it's all well and good for organizations to say, you know, tell us everything that you find, but this is for internal use only. Whereas, you know, there was a real strong push for us to be looking and diving deeper into unintended and negative outcomes as a result of Amnesty's work, with the recognition that it's a public-facing document. So I think there's a lot of, you know, there's that kind of open self-reflection.
I think, yeah, Amnesty were very willing to engage with our findings. And I think that there's a degree of affirmation in knowing that, you know, what we found and our evidence and our reflections is important to the organisation, and that there are signs that they'll take it forward and implement it. And Amnesty were always very willing to engage in what was found and really think about what that looks like in reality or in practice for them. And so as external evaluators and consultants, you know, obviously you're very in and out in the process, but you want to see signs that you are contributing to change in some way or another. Otherwise, why, as, you know, value-driven individuals, do we do this work?
I think there was something, we coined them as well-intentioned gatekeepers, which was interesting in that in the effort to look after partners and campaign participants, there was a kind of a shielding that sort of happened, which meant that our access may have been reduced a bit. And I think that it's easy to understand why, because if you value your stakeholders, you want to make sure that their time is managed well. You want to make sure that there aren't kind of random asks coming out of nowhere. But the other side of that is that their voices may not be heard in spaces where they probably should be heard. And I think that, you know, there was a real balance that was happening in that space of saying, well, okay, how can we make it so that the offer, that there is at least the space created for campaign participants to engage with the evaluation, and that we don't push them if, you know, the timing wasn't right. You know, we wanted to interview a group of students and it was exam time. And so the idea was, right, well, let's make the offer here. And if they aren't able to because of exams, that's it. We won't chase anybody, but we at least want to make sure that the space is afforded to them. So I think there's that bit of balancing, you know, the best of intentions with ensuring that people are heard and that their voices are reflected in an evaluation that critiques the campaign's work.
And that was a huge degree of consideration for ethics and risks taken and all of that. And I think, yeah, it really opened my eyes to the level of thoughtfulness. Maybe just a final point that as external evaluators, the boundaries in which you're involved in organisations, own musings and work and the respect for those boundaries. So I think to come to any kind of conclusion in this podcast for us is please go and read our report.
But, for more concluding remarks.
I mean, I think ultimately in concluding this, we said that Amnesty International UK's Brave campaign did achieve its aim, objectives and outcomes.
Yeah. The ambition was for more people in the UK to be engaged with and campaigning on behalf of human rights defenders in the UK around the world. It was for human rights defenders at risk to feel better protected, and for human rights defenders, particularly women, young people, to feel better protected from threats and reprisals, connected to other human rights defenders, decision makers, agencies, equipped to carry out their work, and recognized for their vital efforts and contributions to the human rights space. Amnesty absolutely contributed to that and did make really strong advances to that. The other end of that, the slightly more critical piece of that, is that that happened in an environment where a number of different things were also interacting with those spaces. But it, you can't deny that Amnesty made contributions to people feeling all of those things and those experiences being realized in their work. So,
and then maybe just to add to that, you know, we did find that people wanted to maintain feedback spaces with Amnesty.
Yeah.
You know, we found that campaigns can't just be looked at as a 3 or 4 year. And actually the sustained engagement with the UK public, with human rights defenders, with stakeholders across the campaign is of real value to the people involved. And they really want to know how things went. They want to know, you know, what was the outcome of certain projects. It's also around tilting, you know, a campaign as an injection of awareness around something into how do we sustain engagement.
And I think that's probably a lesson for a number of organizations, in that your project cycle is a cliff that not only you confront, and that your participants, your project participants also come up against that same cliff. So what does it mean to take a more sustainable approach to engagement?
Great. Well, thank you everybody for listening. We look forward to any feedback or input on the report if you get a chance to read it. That's it for now. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.